So Leandro Fonseca, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks a lot for having me. It's a pleasure.
We are very honored to have you here as the head of research at Hugging Face. And we started talking about Hugging Face very early on in the podcast, which the podcast started after ChatGPT sort of took the world by storm, right? And over the past few years, we've seen Hugging Face. Actually, I know that Hugging Face started in like 2016 as a company that was just providing consumer chatbot, right? And sort of pivoted to become this reference in open source models. And over the past few years, we've noticed an increasing effort to work on your own research and develop your own models. That was a different proposition from the original development of a chatbot. So could you walk us through the decision and the process actually to sort of become this without giving up the fact that you are the lingua franca of open source models, also invest in your own models and on research that has spawned very, very interesting projects over this past couple of years?
Yeah, for sure. Maybe before I get into that, there's also a joke in like the origin story of Hugging Face as it started, as you mentioned, kind of as a chatbot company, where originally Hugging Face was building small chat models for messenger apps. And now we become like kind of an open source AI company, whereas OpenAI did the opposite route, where they started as an open source AI company, and now they're mostly a chatbot company. So the reason Hugging Face started their own research efforts was already there was a research effort when Hugging Face was working on chatbots, just to figure out like what are the state-of-the-art techniques that feed into building those applications more. But now, since Hugging Face has become an open source AI platform, the motivation of doing research is slightly different. The reason why we got into doing our own research and train our own models is mostly because we want to kind of establish the tooling for the whole ecosystem, that everybody can be a frontier lab. So our mission is slightly different from the other frontier lab, as we're on kind of on a meta level. We're trying to enable other people to be able to train these models easily. And one way to do that is to do it ourselves, so we can figure out like what are all the kind of secret recipes that will go into training these models, and then open source everything. So I think we don't aim to be a frontier lab, so we don't train typically very big models. We try to train kind of like small models that allow us to like figure out all the interesting pieces, but then mostly focus actually on the artifacts around the model, which is releasing the data sets that are necessary. These days, almost no company has any interest in releasing data sets anymore, as it's kind of like the secret sauce. Kind of well known that the secret sauce of language models is like the high quality data sets. We do release the recipes. So an example is when ChatGPT came out, nobody knew what it takes to go from a base model to a chat model. Everybody knew OpenAI was probably using reinforcement learning, but like how exactly they did it wasn't known. And kind of like the post-training team at Hugging Face started as like, we need to figure out how to do the same thing and how to turn base models in the community into chat models, so there are more chat models overall. And kind of the long-term vision, or why the motivation why Hugging Face has a research team, is like, if we're in the ecosystem kind of providing the building blocks for other people to build amazing models, then long-term that's going to feed back into like the open source ecosystem, and also like the Hugging Face hub, where more people are sharing models. And so far that's been working quite well. Like there's over, I think now 2.5 million models on the Hugging Face Hub that people have shared. And if you look a little bit over the history of like of language models, it wasn't always clear that open language models are going to play a role. There was a little bit of winter at some point, where after initial like openness of BERT and the early GPT models, after ChatGPT, like everybody kind of closed down. Like Google stopped releasing models. OpenAI wasn't releasing anything anymore. And then the Llama models kind of revived everything a bit. And now we also have like very strong Chinese models, for example. And there is also NVIDIA doing open, but like it wasn't always clear that there's going to be an open component to the LLM ecosystem. So we try to keep the torch burning in a sense.
No more than that. I believe, honestly, that you, by existing, you incentivize them to do that, like the whole community. Basically the same way that GitHub did that for software development back in the day, you are this right now. Like because you are there, people want to share what they're doing and they can get from other people data sets, models. I have models, I have data sets on Hugging Face. So just first of all, thank you for that. But on that note, Leandro, seeing Hugging Face where it is right now, how do you see yourselves as a company, like as an inference provider, model repository? You know, you're all of that, but how do you distinguish what is research, what is product, and how's your business? How do you plan your business to evolve to not be just another hyperscaler?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the way we see ourselves is a little bit like, as I said, like an enabler within the community. So we try to figure out like, what are the things that are most valuable to the community that we can provide? Like early on, it was like people were sharing models on Google Drives. And so the hub for models was like a useful thing and kind of like standardized like sharing models for everyone. Later on, we worked on like data sets and eventually spaces to host demos as well and then provide compute and inference. In the current ecosystem, I think what's kind of important is to stay like very flexible and see a little bit where things are going. So it's very hard for us to say like the AI ecosystem in 2 years is going to look like this and that. So we're going to build out towards that. And I think it's the same on the research side. Like we don't have a long-term plan over the next year or two where we say like these are the milestones that we want to achieve. We try to stay very nimble in the sense that we try to figure out like what are the most useful things that we could do right now and maybe have a little bit like an overall midterm goal of like being useful and building like certain things a little bit bigger, but mainly like experimenting a lot. So for me, for example, inside Hugging Face, it's not like a very big uniform company. In a sense, it's much more a combination of like many small startups. So even in the research team, we have like smaller teams. Typically, like we don't like to have teams that are much bigger than 4 or 5 people. And they experiment on something. And if the experiment is successful, we double down, we increase the team size. If not, the team moves on to something else. And like that, we can kind of stay agile and flexible to see like what are the interesting things coming and what should we do.
And going back to your career, I saw that you studied physics in Zurich in Switzerland, and you worked in data science at startups, and now you're working with research there at Hugging Face. So what made you make this leap from corporate world, basically industry, to open source AI research?
Yeah, I think it was kind of in retrospect, it might look like a very big like jump from one thing to another. Going through it personally, I feel it was more like a continuous evolution of the things I was doing. So when I was studying physics, for example, during the end of my studies, it was kind of clear to me that I didn't want to stay in physics itself, as I felt like on the one hand, academia and physics didn't seem like a super collaborative thing. A little bit, there was a little bit of bitterness in physics academia that I didn't quite like, and like the collaborative nature was a bit missing. And at the same time, I saw like the very first signs of life in AI, but like DeepMind was releasing, for example, the demos of the Atari games. And I was at the time already doing a fair bit of like more numerical physics. So I felt like the jump from numerical physics to machine learning was kind of like a small one, but a logical one. And there was already people at the university doing things like that. So I found some of them and I did pivot during my studies a bit. And then after that, I was wondering like, where could I get my first job doing something like machine learning? And like getting into one of the labs, like DeepMind, seemed like a very far leap. I mean, I tried, But it was kind of hard having not so much like
who hasn't?
Experience. Yeah, exactly. I think many people try. I think now like these companies are bigger and maybe there's more opportunities at the same time. It has also become more competitive as more people are studying it. So it's a bit a two-edged sword. So I thought if I go to a startup doing data science, I can kind of like learn more skills. At that time, like data science and machine learning was still kind of close together. Now they seem very far apart. And then I iteratively like did small career pivots where I did data science in a startup. Then I did data science in an insurance company. But at the insurance company, there was already like a lot of natural language that needed to be processed, like to get all these claims about like, I broke my phone and you need to classify them. You need to understand like what object in that text got broken. And then depending on what it is, you need to see if that's covered. So kind of like was kind of interesting with a lot of NLP applications. And at the same time, I started, I wanted to get into the more modern version of NLP as well with like BERT and language models that came out at the time. And with Louis Tunstall, who I worked already before at the startup, we started working on kind of a series of blog posts that were like the aim was to help us learn how these things work. But then we thought we could learn by educating other people. And this series of blog posts kind of evolved into a book about transformers. And at some point we thought like, if we're writing a book about transformers using Hugging Face tooling, maybe we should ask Hugging Face if they're writing a book about the same thing, because otherwise nobody's going to read our book. So we got in touch with Hugging Face and specifically Tom Wolf, who's one of the co-founders. And it turned out they weren't working on a book yet. And he was excited to join actually the book effort. So we wrote the book together. And at the end of the book, Louis and I kind of asked Tom, hey, we really enjoyed working together. Couldn't we continue doing that? And it was kind of a good opportunity because Hugging Face just raised a little bit of money. So they hired a few more people. And so Louis and I joined Hugging Face. Originally, we were both in the open source team at Hugging Face. I was working on evaluation, for example, but then we both got dragged into more researchy projects. And over time, I started leading more and more of the research efforts at Hugging Face. So it might look like a big jump going from physics to ML research, but like all the small steps in between always seemed like kind of logical and not so extreme.
The way you tell it, it makes complete sense. Like, how could you not take this path, right?
Exactly. It's like I always took like the most obvious step.
And there's, how many people are working in the research department?
Yeah, it depends a little bit on how you count. Like there's the kind of research team that does mostly kind of like LLM related research.
Right.
It's maybe around 20 people. And now a new endeavor of Hugging Face is also doing robotics.
Right.
And so we do have a hardware team, Pollen, that's a company that we acquired. Plus we have an open source team that's maybe I have 7 people at the moment doing open source research on robotics. So 20 to 30 to 40 people, depending a little bit like how you draw the circle.
Right. And how hard or easy is it to bring people in? Because as you said, there's these huge companies that work on open models as well. And I've always gotten the impression that it's sort of like lip service to try to attract talent to actually work on their proprietary models. I'm talking about the huge AI companies and tech companies that have AI divisions. And even though you just said that you went through a funding round, I imagine that this sort of like, it's a bit more constrained than Meta that was just, you know, spilling money to whoever wanted to catch it and come work for them. So what is the talent pool like? Has it been to try to attract people to work in research?
No, it's an interesting question. I think we didn't have that many issues hiring people so far. I think we've been in a quite fortunate situation for a few reasons. On the one hand, I think Hugging Face, as you pointed out earlier, has like a very positive image, I think, in the community in general. So there is a lot of interest to work for Hugging Face and doing research here. Naturally, there is like a subset of researchers, I think, and I think generally people in the community who are not necessarily like pure researchers that really want to work on frontier models. So they want to work in those few labs that do the main but large pre-training runs. But there is a much bigger pool of the people who are not only attracted to work on exactly these things. And for those, for that pool, like Hugging Face is kind of attractive. We do a lot of interesting research, even on pre-training, on data sets, on post-training. And compared to like the very big labs, although in total they have like a lot of GPUs, we also do have a medium-sized GPU cluster. And since we're kind of a small team, the number of GPU per researcher is actually not so bad. So a researcher at Hugging Face might be able to run bigger experiments than a researcher in one of the big labs just because we need to divide our total compute by fewer people. So that's that has been another advantage that sometimes people don't think about. Actually, like the GPU negotiations and wars and politics and big labs are pretty extreme, whereas like having a small team that's kind of aligned and usually works on like similar topics, people are not that bitter about like giving GPUs to a colleague if they have like an exciting project and it's like your win is our win, so let's put our experiments on hold and you go ahead.
How many GPUs do you have? Can you tell us?
Yeah, we have 96 nodes of H100s, so times 8, so it's almost 800 GPUs. So if you divide that by 20, it's like everybody has like 40 GPUs to run experiments, but at the same time, not everybody uses 40 GPUs all the time, right? So some people can use half the cluster for some weeks, for example, or even more, while other people, for example, run ablations on fewer. Another interesting thing is being an open research lab is also attractive if you want to plan your career ahead. So if you work like in one of the big labs, you're not allowed to talk about anything that you're doing, right? Whereas if you work for an open lab, everybody sees what you're doing. And it's like sometimes even a little bit like an issue for us because like the great work of great people gets noticed by everyone because we just publish it and people notice that this guy has been doing really cool stuff. Maybe we should try to hire him. Whereas in big labs, you're a little bit more under the radar.
And there, like you said, you work across everything now, like pre-training, post-training, data sets, evaluation. And in your opinion, what is the real bottleneck today? Is it the data, the algorithms, the infrastructure, the evaluation? Yes to all?
Yeah, a little bit yes to all. I think the bottleneck is always a bit the things that are least attractive to the community to work on. And I think the kind of priority list or things that get most, let's say, like impact or visibility in the community is like first, like if you build a model, if you train a model, like model releases always get a lot of visibility. Data sets a little bit and evaluations, you need to make a really special evaluation to get noticed. But like in terms of importance, it's almost the other way around. Where if you want to build great models, you should start by having really great evaluations. If you don't have really great evaluations, then your whole setup is a little bit screwed because you're going to overfit your data set creation on the benchmarks. And then in the end, you train a model that's on that data set and everything is like tailored to the benchmarks that you have. And if the benchmarks are either not good or they're missing crucial aspects of what the user cares about, then you might have a model that in the end you think is very good because it's very good on those benchmarks, but actually like it's missing in many places. And I think it's a well-known secret at this point that like all the big labs, they have like very good internal benchmarks that are very aligned with what they know users care about, like for coding, for sure. They have like a lot of coding benchmarks that measure all the different ways you want the models to code, and like kind of the open source benchmarks, they improved over time, but like they're probably still lacking behind a fair bit. And I think after that, it's data sets where I think you can never have a too big, too high quality data set. And the community is trying to build better data sets, but and also the big labs are trying to build better data sets. I think like It's pretty clear that if you have a better data set, you're going to end up with a better model. There's not that much secret sauce going on in training. There are a few things to make training either more efficient at train time or inference time, but like making the model absolute better in the end, usually you get the biggest improvements through higher data set quality.
Now, speaking about this, like about data set quality, I think I mentioned this in an episode here recently. I work here at the Barcelona Supercomputing Center. We also train models from scratch. It's all open source. We are on Hugging Face. And we released a new version maybe 3 months ago of our biggest models, a 4DB model. And the thing is, I asked the guys, like, how did it improve so much, like from the one that you guys released in September to the one you released in December, January? So we didn't do anything special. Like the pre-training, we used the same pre-training. We just improved the post-training. We clean our data sets better, and that did the job, basically. But for you guys, that you are doing this on a daily basis, you are creating also guides on how to do it better. What does it mean for me that I have, for example, a small lab and I don't have as many GPUs as you have? It's not the case. Like, we have a lot of GPUs, but I'm saying to the general you who doesn't have as many GPUs, what does it mean to have a good data set or a clean data set? Because it doesn't mean that having more data than another person or another lab that your LLM is going to work better in the end, right?
Yeah, I think it ultimately depends a little bit also on where you are on the spectrum of training. Like if you want to do pre-training or if you want to do kind of more mid-training or post-training, what you want from a data set might change a little bit. So for example, I think on the pre-training side, usually very early on in pre-training, you want to go for diversity. So you want to have clean data for sure. You don't want to train on like boilerplate, I don't know, HTML from websites. You want to clean up as much as possible. You don't want to waste tokens on data that's not interesting, or you don't want to train on like all the open source licenses that are spread all over the internet. So you want to do some cleaning of the data set, but in the end, you want to have maximum diversity because you want to cover as much knowledge and as much different kind of use cases during pre-training as possible if you want to build like a general purpose base model. And then as you go more towards the end of the pipeline in mid-training and post-training, you want to really focus on quality. You want to remove like all the noise that maybe is acceptable during pre-training and really only have data that's very clean. And on the other hand, that's also very close to what you think people will use the model for. Because I think in the early days of pre-training, the paradigm was a bit like we take like as much data as we can, we do a little bit of cleaning, but then magically those models work on like all these use cases. But then it turned out like they were actually kind of brittle in most cases. So you could get with few shots prompting and so on, you could then get them to work on some use cases, but like to really get them to work reliably was very hard. And I think the reason we're now at the stage where you can run Claude code and it executes steps after step and it's very reliable and like the error rate is very, very small, you only need to intervene rarely, is because those models were trained on exactly those use cases and they can recover from small failure cases and so on. So I think if you want to build like a high quality data set for post-training, you want to align it as closely as possible to what you think the people are going to do. And in all those cases, I think especially even more towards like the end of the pipeline, you can make progress even if you don't have that many GPUs. I think for pre-training, it's slightly harder because sometimes it's hard to know by eye what's good data. You want to be more guided by like running ablation, so training a small model and figure out like, did it get better on the benchmarks that we care about? And sometimes the things that matter are a bit counterintuitive. So you might think like that filter for sure removes all the bad data and then you run the filter and it turns actually out you removed some crucial data and the models are worse. I feel towards the end of the pipeline, it's more obvious what's good data by just looking at it. And it's like you look at a trace of maybe some synthetic data you generated and you can see like, this looks exactly like what a user would do. And it's very consistent and not very verbose or whatever. So it's like, I feel you can make progress in that domain. And also doing ablations in the post-training stage is much cheaper because you can just fine-tune a model and see if you get any signal.
When you think about these labs nowadays, do you think they are doing most of their post-training with synthetic data only?
Yeah, probably. And even their pre-training has a substantial amount of synthetic data. I think one data point that's interesting to look at is the Nemotron releases that recently came out from NVIDIA, which is, I think, a nice contrast to the Chinese releases, as they also released all the data set and recipes, which typically the Chinese labs also don't release. They release the models, but they don't release the secret sauce in there, whereas the Nemotron report is very detailed. And you can look at the data distribution, for example, for pre-training. And I think I eyeballed it like the other day. I think it's like 30% of the pre-training data they synthetically augmented in some way. And in the post-training stage, it's like it's been synthetic for a while now. Like most of the SFT data sets after ChatGPT have been ChatGPT created. So they've already been synthetic to some degree. And I think now people do it even more. And the other thing that now comes into play is that a lot of the post-training steps are actually in environments. And I think this is also synthetic data, can be considered as synthetic data, because you have the model itself interacting with an environment, and then you train on the traces that you get on that. And there's no like manually human written text in there. Mm-hmm. Maybe the prompt is the remaining thing.
And you mentioned the Chinese open-ish models that have been making the rounds, right? And we've been hearing sort of like anecdata about how there's this tsunami coming of the Chinese models being ready and ripe to sort of overcome all Eastern open models because it's cheaper to run, whether it you're using an API or actually cheaper to run them locally. Do you see that from Hugging Face, being from the vantage point that you are? Is this something that it's actually might become a threat, or is it more like people are just talking about it because they think it's a cool idea that this might happen?
No, I think they're kind of like a very solid cornerstone of the community at this point. I think especially the community that we see, because it heavily relies on like open source, right? Open models, right? It's like everything that goes through the hub is an open model, and like the Chinese models have been kind of like at the forefront for a while now. So they're very important there. But even for like companies, these models are very important, as like I think cost is one thing. Traditionally, it has been a bit hard for most smaller companies or medium-sized companies to really justify that, because you need to have like a few GPUs running with those models. And for most use cases, you don't have like a huge token count that's produced, right? Like if you have 10 users that chat with your model, probably you can't utilize like your GPU instance that's running that model. But if you look now at like how much money people spend on decoding models, where you actually they execute or they generate like thousands or hundreds of thousands and millions of tokens every hour for one user, you get into the regime where you can easily actually utilize those instances. So I think it's becoming more and more attractive from a cost standpoint. And the other aspect is that's very crucial for many companies is just simple privacy concerns, right? Where code is still considered like kind of like the most valuable IP within most companies. And like sending your code bases to an external API is like a hard thing to do. So if you can avoid it, some companies just aren't allowed to do it. And some other companies need to go through like legal processes to get approval to use these toolings. And then open models that can run locally. And somebody needs to kind of set up the inference servers. But these days, that's much easier than what it used to be a few years ago. Another interesting data point is like startups that want to build things, AI startups, especially also like in Silicon Valley. Everybody who wants to train models is currently relying on these Chinese models, because if your business is not being a frontier lab, but maybe you want to do a model for a specific application, you want to train or fine tune the best model that's out there for your specific use case. Could be like in science, like startups that want to do material science or startups that want to build a model that's really good in answering health-related questions, then you want to take like the best model that's out there and fine-tune it. And you, the only models that you can do that to is like open models. And there hasn't been many like Western models that were really at the forefront. I think Nemotron is a nice effort. There's LNAI who's doing the OMA models that are a little bit smaller. But yeah, generally, I think there's a huge demand for open models.
And now from the fun part. There are many models that have come out of Hugging Face over the last couple of years, right? And one of the models that seems to be getting the most traction both from within and without the company is the whole small LM initiative, if I may call it an initiative. Like, it's sort of like this whole thing now. So would you mind going through how it came about? And then we can talk a little bit about how it's evolving and, I don't know, spreading around.
Yeah, for sure. So the Small LM initiative, as you call it, started also as a little bit as a small project. As I said earlier, usually we start things a little bit with small experiments and see a little bit where things go. And we initially started experimenting with synthetic data. It was around the time when the Phi models from Microsoft were released, and there was this textbooks is all you need paper. I forgot the exact name, but essentially showing like if you train your model on small synthetic data sets that kind of simulate textbooks, then you get like a very good model. And we thought, oh, that's an interesting thing to experiment a bit with. Can we kind of reproduce the Phi experiments? And it was essentially a team of two people at this point. It was Lubna, who I worked with on the coding models before, and Anton, who worked together and built like this synthetic data set first called Cosmopedia, which was like challenging in itself, like the first like kind of larger scale fully synthetic data set that we built. And we needed to figure out how to do that in the first place. And then we trained a small model on it. And that was called Cosmo. So Cosmopedia was the data set and Cosmo was the model. And as we continued experimenting, it turned out like if you want to build a really good model, probably makes sense to mix in a little bit of real data as well, not do like purely synthetic run. And then at some point we thought like maybe let's just try to build the best small model full stop rather than just doing the best model on synthetic data. And we started doing some ablations and figuring out like what kind of data sets should we use. And in parallel, we had this effort by Guilherme Antinek, who worked on FineWeb, which is a web scale pre-training data set. And so it was a nice combination of the two, where we kind of had like the small model training running well, and we had someone who built like a really good web data set. So we experimented a bit like, how do you actually train like the best model? So we took FineWeb, plus we added a few other small data sets. We experimented a bit with the mix, and we released Small LM one initially.
When was it?
When was that? Like, I think 1.5 years ago,
right,
probably, yeah. Roughly.
2024, I was checking the page now.
Yeah.
<All right.
laughs> Yeah, time's flying. And then we kind of continued that spirit a bit, and we had an okay-ish recipe, I would say, and then we doubled down and tried to figure out like how can we make everything better, and we built smaller than two. Which was an iteration mostly on the data set, also a bit experiments on the architecture. And then Small LM3 is kind of a slightly larger model. So Small LM2, I believe we had a 100 million, a 300 million, and a 1 billion parameter model. And Small LM3 was a 3 billion parameter model, where we took all the learnings from Small LM2, iterated again a bit more on the data set, and ran some more ablations, also put a little bit more focus on how can we make those models really good at slightly longer context tasks. And so we built Small LM 3, which is a 3B model. And at the time when we released it, was kind of state of the art in the Pareto frontier. It's like if you look at the different model sizes, for its model size, it was kind of the best model out there.
No, and it was pretty amazing. We were using it actually, like testing against our models, using it as a benchmark as well. So congratulations on that. And going to the last phase of the training, We speak a lot about reinforcement learning these days. And you guys, you released the TRL, the training reinforcement learning, back in the day, so like years ago, basically. And it's still there. People are still using it a lot. You implemented the new techniques now, like not so new anymore, even like GRPO and STO, DPO, all of that. But when it comes to this, how did you apply the reinforcement learning to your small LM models? And what do you think, what technique is underrated nowadays? Which one is overrated, do you think, among these that are being used out there?
Yeah, I think indeed TRL started like a very long time ago. This was actually originally like a project I did to also get into NLP. It was like just before we started working on the book, I tried to implement a paper from OpenAI, which did like reinforcement learning with language models. So it was more a side project that got revived when ChatGPT came out and people were super interested in how this works. When it comes to the things that matter most, I think when I talk to people who get a little bit into the field, I think the thing that they're mostly excited about is like the reinforcement learning techniques, because I think intellectually they're the most interesting ones, trying to figure out like how can you learn most effectively and efficiently from reward signals. But what we found is typically like you can get a lot of already out of like the SFT phase. So usually our recipes also have a little bit of like a pyramid structure. We spend a lot of effort first on SFT. And I think typically you get like, I don't know, 75 or 80% of your performance already if you curate like a very high quality SFT data set. And it's intellectually very simple. You just continue kind of like the pre-training paradigm, right? You just do next token prediction and you have next token prediction loss. But that gets you actually very far. The thing that we typically do next is DPO, which is not is kind of like somewhere in the middle between reinforcement learning and SFT, where you do more contrastive loss. You have like samples, kind of paired samples with good examples and bad examples, and that helps the model distinguish between like this is what I should do and this is what I shouldn't do, which is not kind of signal that you get from SFT alone. In SFT, because of like the way the loss is set up, you just learn this is how I should do things, but the model never discriminates of like, oh, this was a bad example. Maybe I should avoid this kind of scenario, where DPO gives you that. And then GRPO is what we typically use at the end, because it works fairly well, gives you kind of the cherry on top and can get your model like really good on specific applications, especially the ones that you can verify, for example, math and coding. You can boost the performance a little bit, but people typically underestimate like how far you can go by just like curating and hyperparameter tuning the shit out of your SFT pipeline before moving on. But like people are always anxious, like I want to go ahead, I want to do RL, I don't want to spend too much time doing the boring stuff. But usually even our post-training team, they want to do like reinforcement learning, but then they spend 80% of the time in the SFT phase and run out of time doing doing the RL part.
And are you planning already on small LM4? I mean, should be on the works, right?
Actually, we pivoted slightly. So we still are doing kind of like pre-training related things. But what we found is like the way we frame the research problem that we work on is always like, where do we get like the maximum leverage for the community out of? Like, is it the best effort that we spend that gives the community most value? And when we started doing small LM, we were kind of like the only one doing small models. Like there were some teams doing small models as well, but it was more like a side thought. Now, if you look at like, for example, Qwen4b has almost become a flagship model for the Qwen team. You can see like they spend a lot of time on the 4b model and on the very large models, and the ones in between, they're also good, but you clearly notice like the 4b model is very important. And so the question is like, should we compete with Qwen like at every iteration? But also there's other teams now, like the Allen AI is doing cool smaller models as well. So one thing that we work on a little bit more these days is doing models that are applied to interesting use cases. And one of these domains is, for example, AI for science, which is a super interesting field at the moment, right, where you take those models and try to and insights and see, like, can you do similar interesting things, but do it for the sciences? So it could be like math or physics or biology or chemistry. And the really nice thing is it's such a wide field at the moment. Like, you can pick any domain pretty much, and there's interesting things to do. And at the same time, if you succeed, there is a very big value to the community or to humanity as in general, right? If you can improve or accelerate the sciences, that's something like the team at Hugging Face is super excited about. Also because I think we have a lot of physicists and scientists. So naturally, we tend to be interested in these kind of problems. So that's something that we're working on at the moment quite a bit.
It's funny that you... Everything that you said, I have to say that we are doing more or less the same, like Hugging Face and the Supercomputing Center here in Barcelona, because we're, right now I'm involved in a project which is called LLMs for EU, for the European Union, where we are fine-tuning models for science, like science, the different use cases actually, but one of them is general science, the other is like telecommunications, public services and that, but we also kind of coincidentally ended up having the same decision.
Yeah. I think also one thing that's interesting is that if you talk to the people who do pre-training, for example, like sometimes when you talk to people from the big labs or in some of the open labs that do those things, that work on pre-training, you get a little bit of a sense that a lot of them are actually super burned out, because at this point, like, you're past a little bit the this is a new green field era, and you're in the grinding era where it's like everybody knows what it takes to do a good model. It's like you need to get your distributed training working very smoothly, so there's people debugging distributed bugs all day, right, and getting those systems stable, which is an interesting engineering task, but it's also super stressful because you're handling huge GPU clusters that cost like thousands of dollars every hour or every minute that you're using them or they're not running. And on the data side, it's similar, right? You just need to grind. You need to build better data sets. You need to run more ablations, and you need to repeat all the time. So you have a lot of pressure and you need to grind a lot. So I think naturally a lot of people are looking a little bit at new things, and it's like, I mean, there's certainly value in continuing pre-training. I'm not saying like people should stop doing it. And I think it's still interesting, but at the same time, it's not the only interesting thing that you can currently doing and thinking about like new applications where you can say like, maybe we don't need to be the N+1 lab that does the pre-training of roughly the same model as everybody else, but maybe we can bring something a little bit more unique to the table. I think is a nice perspective. And I think sciences is a natural place to look where there is a clear benefit to everyone if you succeed to make a better model.
Who makes this decision? Is it you or Clem?
I think it's more me and Tom. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, really? Cool.
Yeah.
We spoke recently with Randall Balestriero from Meta, right? And he was talking a lot about how science is one of the most promising applications of the whole world models thing that is being seen coming out of what he's been doing and investigating. Have you been sort of looking at world models, or is this something that it's not yet time to, you know, doesn't make sense for Hugging Face, or does it interest you personally?
Yeah, no, I think it's an interesting topic. We haven't had like a huge active effort so far in doing our own world models. We've been thinking a little bit about it and experimenting a little bit, but more in the domain of robotics,
right,
which is, I think, a more immediate application, right? If you have like a very good world model, maybe you can kind of use it as a simulator and train your policy of like a robotic arm or whatever inside your world model, and then take it out and see if it still works in the real world. I think that's where I see currently like the most immediate interest. But generally, I think world models are an interesting topic.
And speaking of robots, Hugging Face has the Richie Mini, right? Which is this cute, awesome little robot. I can't wait to get my hands on one. Hint, hint. What have you learned from this as an experiment, as a product? How has it been?
It's been very interesting as a company as well, because Hugging Face has been a software company essentially almost the past 10 years, right?
Right.
Where all we did was building products or the hub or doing research, which is everything is digital. And suddenly we're building a robot now, so we need to order parts. We're also not doing a prototype, so we need to order thousands of those parts. And we need to figure out where you get those. And suddenly you notice like some of those parts have like a limited supply in the world. So you need to figure out these things. So we had people traveling to China several times to figure out like how do we set up a supply chain. But it also has been a very rewarding thing. We saw now videos of people kind of unpacking the robots, and I don't know if you know, but like the robot is, you have to assemble it yourself, so it doesn't come pre-built. And initially people were a little bit like, why do you do that? Like, nobody wants to build their own product, but it actually turned out people are really happy to build their own product. And
tell that to IKEA, right?
or Lego.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. I think it's like, it's much more fun to play with something that you built and you're kind of part of the journey. And then also seeing people using it for all kinds of like different things, like the idea of the Ricci Mini is also being more like a learning platform. So you can program it yourself, you can build in your own policy or your own behavior of what you want the robot to do. So it's again, we're not building like a robot like that everybody else is building, but it's a little bit a unique robot. But that's still very interesting to a lot of people who want to get into robotics, because it's only like a few hundred dollars, which is a lot of money in some sense, but it's also not a lot of money in the robotics industry, right? Where you could spend $10,000 for just a medium-sized normal robot, and a few hundred dollars to experiment is like an acceptable entry point for many.
I mean, it's an AI robot who went back 15 years and said there's going to be an AI robot that is just a few hundred dollars. Nobody would believe you. So, yeah.
Yeah, the thing that's really mind-blowing to me, if you would send kind of Ricci Mini back with like Qwen 4B running on board, you would have like a full Alexa experience, right?
Right.
Like the model could, or a Jarvis from Iron Man. It's like all the capabilities are there now. And like just 4 or 5 years ago, the Alexa team was a few thousand engineers trying to figure out how do we understand and route voice commands from users in their home that want to know what the weather is tomorrow, right? And now it's like you order a robot, you tinker a bit yourself in the afternoon, and you get like all that at home, and you can build whatever you want.
It is awesome.
It's pretty amazing. And imagine I'm a, I don't know, an investor, angel investor. Unfortunately, I'm not. But if I gave you a double or triple or quadruple your budget, where would you invest nowadays? Just GPUs or something else?
I think at these days, we're actually not even that much GPU bound. It depends a little bit what you want to do. I think if you want to be a frontier lab, I mean, also don't tell like most of the people in the research team. I think you can always have more GPUs. People won't say no. But I think generally for the things we want to do, we're not that much GPU bound, because we're not strictly in the pre-training regime anymore. And I think you can do a lot of interesting mid-training and post-training at the current scale that we have. I think I wouldn't say no to double our cluster and increase a little bit our experiment. I think at the moment, what we're working on quite hard is like building a bit more like the open infrastructure around a lot of these things. I think if I asked you like do some mid-training or post-training of like the biggest open model that there is, you wouldn't be, first of all, like limited by GPUs. I think you would need the GPUs, but even if I gave you the GPUs, you couldn't start training tomorrow. It's like you would need to figure out like for pre-training, we've gone through that process now at the moment with a project that we're a little bit involved in, where we try to pre-train an MoE model on a public cluster. And it's like such a pain compared to dense models. And there are all these recipes that are out there and even some libraries, but they're like very optimized for one kind of infrastructure. But suddenly you're not on a Blackwell cluster, you're an H100 cluster, so a lot of the kernels don't exist, or you don't have InfiniBand interconnect, so all those kernels don't exist, or all you can't use those libraries. So we're working a little bit on these things. These are a little bit limiting. And then also on the post-training side, a limiting factor is just like the public tooling to do post-training is not quite there yet. I think TRL works really well if you want to do a mid-size dense model, do post-training on a mid-size dense model. But if you really want to go to the edge and say, like, we want to post-train the largest MOE there is with, like, thousands or millions even of environments and do reinforcement learning with, like, 1 million token context, all the infrastructure in all kinds of places would break apart. So I think if I had more money and more people, that's one place to focus the investment on at the moment.
What are the challenges that you're finding by trying to train MOEs?
I think just getting the utilization that you get for dense models is much harder. So these parser models require way more communication between GPUs than the dense models. It's like if you probably want to do things like expert parallelism, but like the most tooling doesn't really support efficient expert parallelism unless you have an InfiniBand GPU cluster, and ideally it's Blackwell. And if you step away from that, suddenly all the things are not optimized anymore. And I think people are used to getting like hardware utilization of like 40% when they train a dense model. But suddenly you change to an MOE and you're like at 5-10%, and you're like, this is not great. It was like, how do I justify training four times longer when things should be more efficient? So yeah, this is a bit the pain at the moment. And the ecosystem is catching up. I think there's a lot of movement, for example, in Megatron to add those features and to make things more efficient. But we're not quite there yet. And also, those things always first are optimized for like the ideal cluster, but like not really like the consumer hardware or even like the public infrastructure, which often deviates a little bit from having just buying like the state-of-the-art cluster from NVIDIA.
So the next guide that's coming out is how to train your own small MOE. Not really.
Yeah, there is a plan to write a blog post along those lines.
Amazing.
Yeah. from all the it's I think now 6 months of painful learning how to try to get things optimized.
And Leandro, my last question for you is, thinking about all the research and products that came out of Hugging Face, what has been either the most surprising or rewarding thing that you've seen from as a result of your direct work in there?
Yeah, so I think on our side, I think what I find most interesting is that We work on all these things like fine web and small LM. And sometimes, I mean, we get great feedback when we release those models. I think there's a lot of attention we get on Twitter or on Reddit and so on. So that's rewarding. But then a week or two after, you kind of fall back into your vacuum and you're like, I've released it. We do something else now. And then half a year later or so, you go to a conference or you go to a workshop and you talk to people and you notice like a lot of people are using the tooling that you've been working on. Like we went to Calm last year at the end of the year, and almost every slide in every like presentation that was related to language model training used fine web as a baseline. It's like, oh, this is super nice. Like that was a useful contribution to the community. So I feel that that's very rewarding to see like that these things actually get like a lot of mileage out for a lot of researchers and community members. I think the other way around, like things that had a lot of impact on us, I think as probably everybody noticed, like in the field the past 6 months has been the adaption of coding models, where we noticed like almost nobody in the research team writes a lot of code themselves anymore. Like, of course, obviously there is a lot of like review and iteration, or you humans are very much involved in making things work and making them better. But like actually hands-on coding has become quite a rare thing to do, and to the point where we experimenting with like giving Cloud Code a little bit of access to the cluster to run some experiment. I had it run some data ablations like a few weeks ago, where it's like, here's a data set. I want to get all biology related high quality data out of that web dump. And Claude went on and I gave it some instruction how to do things. So it wrote a logbook. It like was very structured around doing the experiments and even looked at samples and figured out, this is a weird edge case. I need to add another filter. And then iteratively ran ablations on the cluster. And I think this had a significant impact on how we do things, on the things that we can do. It's like another example is like working on evaluations, where it's like, we need to integrate this new benchmark into our evaluation suite. And like a year ago, it was like 1 or 2 week project, because you need to really make sure everything is exactly correctly set up. And if you have a white space too much somewhere in the evaluation prompt, the models might be garbage. And these things are very hard to spot and takes a long time to really get all the bugs out. But these models, they're very good at paying attention to that kind of details, right? It's like for a human, it's hard to spot a white space. But for a model, it's like spotting an exclamation mark somewhere.
Right.
Those models have been really useful.
And has your view changed in any way working at Hugging Face and seeing the open source ecosystem in the last 2 to 3 years? Has your opinion changed?
About the role of the open ecosystem?
Yeah.
I wouldn't say it changed dramatically. I think 2-3 years ago, I was much more of the opinion that we're at the point where it could go both ways. And it's like there was a lot of pressure, for example, from some of the big labs to shut down, for example, in the US, open model development, because there was a lot of fears, like if these models are openly released, that's a national security threat. So maybe we should shut it down. And on the other hand, also wasn't very clear like who would actually be the champion that builds open models. At the moment, it seems like we're in a nice ecosystem where it's like even with like the recent drama at Qwen, I'm not so worried that like there's another lab that's going to pick up, right? It's like they're not the only one doing those things. So I feel like over the past 2-3 years, I continuously sleep a little bit better. And I think now it's a safe thing to say. I think that open and closed models are just going to coexist. Not saying like closed models will completely disappear or open models going to completely disappear. I think both have a place in the whole ecosystem, and you can use both for different use cases and for different people.
People tend to try to minimize every situation into being either one or the other. Like, no, there's space for every, there's different applications, different models, different purposes. It doesn't have to be either one or the other, right? It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. And even in the closed lab ecosystem, right? I feel like 3 years ago, 2 years ago, especially when GPT-4 came out, I think ChatGPT was one point, but when GPT-4 came out, if you look at like the LMSIS scores at the time, like GPT-4 was like at the very top, so far ahead and rumored to have been so expensive that it wasn't clear that anybody would actually catch up to OpenAI anymore, right? And now if you look at LMSIS leaderboard or any other benchmark, it's kind of interchangeable, right? It's like, sure, Claude is maybe currently a little bit better at coding. Maybe Codex is a little bit better. Maybe Gemini is better at math. But they're so close to each other for most use cases, it's very hard to notice the difference. And things might change in 2 months. Like, whoever's best now, maybe tomorrow another lab releases a new checkpoint of a model that's going to be better at coding than Claude or Codex. And I feel like that's the ideal scenario, right? Where the big labs fight each other to become the best. And it's like, it's very tough for them, but like, it's very good for the consumer, because in the end, like you get the best models and you don't get a monopoly, which I think is a good ecosystem generally.
Yeah, never a dull moment for everyone involved. So that's good. Yeah. Win-win.
Exactly.
And for me, the best thing is that the community has been able to keep up with all of this, like releasing with DeepSeek, Quen models, and now even recently with the Kimi models that supposedly are almost the same level as Claude. So we've been able to keep up with the level that these top-notch American labs have been releasing. Of course, the Chinese labs are also top-notch, but at least they are releasing these open weights, right?
Yeah, and I think there is even a technical reason that this is true, and I think it's because distillation is so effective.
Mm-hmm.
So whoever gets an advantage, like everybody else, gonna distill in one way or another from them. And it's like if you ask models about their identity, right? It's like you get a mix of like, hey, I'm ChatGPT, hey, I'm DeepSeek, and it just shows you like all the models train on all the other models. So whenever somebody is pushing a little bit ahead, it's like in the very worst case, like people can catch up with just like distilling from those models. And it's also another reason why smaller models get much better, because it kind of trickles down. It's like the frontier labs distill all from each other, and then the smaller models distill from the larger models, and you kind of equalize the whole field all the time.
Yeah, exactly. And I have one last question, Leandro, which is our audience have a lot of people who work with AI, that being developers, but also AI researchers and all that. What is the path that they should follow if they want to work at Hugging Face with you developing this amazing company?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think for us, what always catches our attention is people who already work on similar projects to ours and also do work in the open. So I think one of the best ways to, I mean, get noticed by us, but I think the nice thing is you also get noticed by every other lab, is building very cool things in the open. And there's a lot of stories where people build like a cool benchmark or a cool model or a cool data set or a cool application. And they kind of got a little bit Twitter famous, and then they joined like one of the big labs or Hugging Face. There has been all this speed running, for example, last year. And the main guy who was running the speed running of the small model training then eventually got to OpenAI. So I think that's generally a great strategy. It's like try to build something that's very interesting, a cool project. And another thing I think, which is getting more and more important, is like I think in the earlier days, you could got away with like building cool examples, but kind of everybody was building a little bit the similar examples. And it was kind of like, I fine-tuned this model on this data set, and I released my Jupyter notebook or a simple block. I think now what's helping much more is if you can specialize yourself in some way. So I think it's nice to be a generalist on some level, but then it's also nice if you're an expert at least in one niche. So I think if you want to get a job in the industry at the moment, I think it's always good to have like a broad knowledge of all the things that are going on, but it helps you a lot if you can show like, I'm very good, for example, at optimizing inference, or I have a very deep understanding on how to do distributed training. So maybe trying to find the things where you can combine a bit of both, where you have a little bit of breadth and maybe on some level, but then also just go very deep on some other level. It could also be like specialization, where you say like, I'm super excited about math models, so I'm really going to dive in and figure out like how all these benchmarks work and what all the tricks are to make models really good at math, rather than saying like, I fine-tuned 100 models on 100 different data sets and they're all okay, but not so clear what the value is.
Yeah.
Leandro, thank you very much for your time, for sharing your knowledge with us. And if folks want to maybe continue this conversation with you, where should I go?
I mean, the easiest place to find me is on X or Twitter. I'm LBWERRA. And the same essentially on LinkedIn. Or, I think those are the best places to reach me.
Beleza, os links vão estar aqui na descrição. Obrigado mais uma vez pelo seu tempo. Parabéns pelo seu trabalho de toda a sua equipe. E para você que já está aqui na descrição, você vai encontrar também o link para aproveitar uma das suas últimas oportunidades, suas últimas chances, últimos dias, basicamente, para você se inscrever e ir com o Fabrício, com o Paulo Silveira, comigo também, Marcel Almeida, da PM3, para o Vale do Silício de 31 de agosto ao dia 4 de setembro, visitar muitas das empresas que a gente comenta aqui a todo episódio. Fabrício, Ajuda eu a convencer o pessoal aqui a clicar no link.
Olha, vai ser uma viagem que a gente vai visitar todas essas empresas que a gente geralmente comenta aqui. Talvez não todas, mas muitas delas. E além das empresas, a gente também vai ter acesso a universidades que têm laboratórios que estão fazendo também a ciência de base por trás disso. Centros de pesquisa enormes lá na Califórnia que estão estudando isso e que têm professores que tanto publicam sobre esse assunto quanto alguns deles têm até empresas, startups sobre inteligência artificial que também estão construindo esse futuro da IA. E eu acho que a parte mais divertida vai ser que você vai estar lá comigo, com o Marcos, com o Paulo Silveira e com o Marcel Almeida, para a gente poder discutir com essas pessoas que vão estar lá nas empresas nos recebendo, mas também entre nós de como nós podemos implementar ou trazer vários desses conhecimentos aqui para o Brasil também.
Sem dúvida, eu passo aí na descrição do episódio para já deixar tudo em ordem, ter parte de visto, ter parte de passagem, ter parte de hospedagem. Demora um tempinho para deixar isso azeitado? Então passe na descrição e entre em contato com a Startse. E lembrando que se você falar escuta já sobre o controle, tem um descontinho esperando por você. Talvez. Então passa aqui na descrição e pega o link. E eu e o Fabrício voltaremos sexta-feira com o nosso resumão das notícias do mundo da inteligência artificial. Até lá!
Este podcast foi produzido pela Alura. Mergulhe em tecnologia. E Faculdade FIAP. Let's Rock the Future. Edição Rede Gigahertz de Podcasts.